Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her website's jugglingdynamite.com and venablepark.com. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Jim.
Danielle, where are we in the equities cycle?
Well, we were in the corrective phase that began in the end of 21, early 2022, all the way till last fall in October. The average investor portfolio dropped 35% during that time. Pretty much every financial asset plummeted. And then since last fall, there's been optimism that the inflation cycle had peaked and that the U.S. central bank, primarily the Fed, would be looking to ease policy rates or ease financial conditions. And in response to that, the equity market in particular went off to the races, anticipating that as a positive, and has proceeded to loosen financial conditions without the Fed doing any easing by more than a full percentage of 100 basis points. The easing has happened in the form of higher stock prices and higher corporate debt prices, which means that yields that they're paying have come off from last fall, as well as equity companies, publicly traded companies, have used the opportunity of investor mania again in the past few months to sell new shares into that flow and to raise some cash. It's a form of cheap financing, and so it's been a self-fulfilling prophecy. As they've done that, they've also returned to share buybacks. You know, they were doing very little share buybacks during when prices crashed in 2020-21, and they began to really wade in fully again in the past couple of years. So that those forces, the buybacks from the companies themselves, has been the primary purchasing power driving assets higher. At the same time, in the last little while, and particularly the last couple of weeks, you've seen a resurgence in the retail investor crowd. So when you look at that, retail investors have been piling into these two times, three times leverage ETFs, very indicative of what they were doing at the cycle peak in late 21, early 22. They've also been doing a lot of this same day option trading. They've, you know, recently this week, the old Roaring Kitty, that, you know, meme stock, platform, that encouraged everyone to start trading their brains out on Robinhood, at the peak in 2022. He began tweeting some peculiar videos this week, which, caused some of his followers to think he had come back, like the Messiah has returned, right after their frenzied activity around his tweets that drove up the price of bankrupt companies like GameStop and AMC in 2022. And then there was that great movie, if you haven't seen it, I recommend that everyone watch it. It's called Dumb Money. It came out last summer, I think. But it was basically chronicling that whole episode of how Roaring Kitty incited the masses to begin trading day trading and to go against hedge funds who were long some of these instruments. And you had this sort of big standoff between two highly speculative risk-seeking entities, the retail crowd on the one and the hedge fund community on the other. So anyway, that was all the madness that was, but it's back, Jim. It's back. So clearly the price declines, the losses, that happened between 22 and 23 were not deep and long enough to wipe people out enough that they, you know, basically repent and go back to doing something more productive. So they have come out blazing with whatever capital they can raise. They're, you know, borrowing on credit cards at all-time highs. Buy now, pay later schemes people are doing to pay for things like rent and groceries and, you know, just basic necessities, which means they're, you know, cash-strapped, completely busted. And then there's all these schemes to try and get them to borrow more. So it's what happened this week was that, you know, stock markets went back to new highs around about the 2022 levels, slightly above for the U.S. markets, which have been, of course, the main center of attraction for the world in the past couple of years, led by the 10 most expensive tech companies, which have made, you know, a massive concentration, an all-time record concentration as far as the index goes. They've contributed 78% of the earnings growth that's happened in the last year, whereas the bulk of the 493 companies that make up the S&P 500 have actually seen negative earnings growth in that time period. So you have this huge dichotomy between, you know, that basket of shares on the one hand that are continuing to benefit from easy financial conditions and a belief that they will, you know, never go down again. And then also they're the ones doing the primary amount of the buying back of their own shares, which is a support to their prices. And then you have the retail crowd coming back with a vengeance. So all those factors have really bid up the price of shares again, and also the price of debt, junk debt. Corporate bonds have outperformed government bonds by the most in the last 100 years, just since the bottom in 2020. So you got a straight up line in terms of price gains for those instruments, because they were briefly deeply discounted and sold off in 2020 when it looked like the economy was falling apart. Then of course the government's come in with all the fiscal backstops and the central banks with cutting rates to zero again, and those things really took off like a rocket. Just an example, you know, AMC, which is one of the companies that this whole meme stock mania was trading in the 2022 cycle, and before it all crashed, then they said, hey, we're going to try and raise some more capital. So they initiated a announcement that they were going to issue 250 more million in new stock, but they've been sitting on that waiting for just such an event as they got this week. So sure enough, the roaring kitty drops these nondescript videos, the meme stock crowd goes crazy, everyone runs in bidding up the share price, and AMC hits that bid and sells $250 million of new shares, takes that cash out to fund their operations and refinance some of their higher interest rate debt, and the stock abruptly plunges thereafter, taking the retail crowd down again. So it's just, it's wild to watch. It really is. But in the process, you know, the things like the broad economy stocks, the Russell 2000 still below where it peaked, in still about 7% below its May 2021 peak. So it really is this sort of specific story of U.S. markets in particular, which have now traded back up to all-time high valuations, 180% of the U.S. GDP, whereas the rest of the world is not back to where it was in 2021 in terms of their stock prices to GDP. They're about 61%. So you've really got a huge overvaluation in a handful of things that's really making things look more bullish than they are under the surface. And the other factor, of course, is that when central banks start cutting rates, and, you know, this week the CPI data came out a little more benign, certainly than people had feared in terms of the U.S. that data. And so the odds of a July rate cut went up to 40% and 100% by September. Just looking at that, thinking, okay, unemployment is starting to rise. You know, jobless claims ticked up to 222,000 for the week of May 11th, initial jobless claims in the U.S. So you've got this kind of deterioration going on in the labor market. And the head of the FOMC, Jerome Powell, had said in a recent conference that, they're watching the unemployment data, and of course, their base case is that the U3, the unemployment rate in the U.S., won't go above 4.1% in this cycle. Well, it ticked up to 3.9 just recently. So as soon as we start to see this CPI moderation, as well as weakness in the labor market, people start to think that the Fed may cut, as I say, by September. And that had really backed up in the past few months to people were thinking maybe they weren't going to cut at all this year, or maybe they were going to even hike rates further. So we've seen a big rally in the bond market as well in terms of the government bond market, because, you know, it had taken the Fed at its word and had sold off again in the past few months in recognition of this idea that maybe they won't be cutting interest rates this year. But in the past few days, as I say, that's kind of turning again, and the government bonds have been rallying significantly. The capital gain on the long bond was up actually as much as the S&P the other day. So there's quite a opportunity, I think, in the bond side of things that have sold off, not the corporate debt, as I say, that's become unhinged like the equity market in terms of bidding up too high. But the government bond market is discounted, yielding, you know, more than 4%, and has really good prospects when you get into an easing cycle. So that story will play out, and we'll see how quickly.
China is ready to write down real estate values. Are other countries ready to do that, or do they have to do that?
Well, it'll be interesting because China, as I've pointed out before, China is really leading the property market cycle here, because they started to implode back in 2021 with some of their major property developers having defaulting on their debts, unable to make payments. Then we've had the property prices in most of the major Chinese cities falling now for more than 3 years. You've got consumers, households that had piled in when rates were cheap, and they believed this was the road to riches for them. Even if they couldn't afford to live in some of these condos they were buying, they were doing them on this idea that it was an investment. Well, of course, the prices falling have really demoralized that sentiment around the consumer and their love affair with real estate. And so now we have a massive amount of unused or empty properties piling up while, you know, builders are going bust and banks have got bad loans climbing to all-time highs on their balance sheets. And so this is, you know, there's quite a significant uptick in unemployment in China as well, especially in the young people. There's a lot of unrest that's coming out of all this. Again, once the public figures out that, you know, their get-rich-quick schemes that they were encouraged to take on during the bubble have burst and actually made them poorer, not richer, then you get a lot of sour sentiment and people starting to have unrest and being very angry and critical of the government. So they're looking at that and thinking, okay, how are we going to quell some of this? How are we going to take this malinvestment that has gone into these expensive properties that the average household cannot afford to live in? How can we make them useful? You know, otherwise we just have to basically knock these buildings down. And there has been some of that where they just think, okay, that was totally malinvested capital. No one can afford to live in them or maintain them or pay the, you know, the maintenance fees, never mind taxes. So they're thinking, how can we rejig this? And so the latest idea at the April 30 Politburo meeting was to say, what if we get distressed developers? What if the banks, basically the governments, use the banks to buy properties at really steep discounts off of the developers so that they get some cash? And then the properties that we buy, how do we convert them into affordable housing? So I actually highlighted that on the blog this week because I think it is a step in the right direction. As I've mentioned, the plans, generally speaking, the housing bubble was, you know, epic all over the world. The plans to date as the thing has been deflating, have been mostly along the lines of how do we get people to get more money out of their retirement savings accounts so they can muster up a down payment? How do we get them to take on more debt? How do we securitize that debt to somehow get more availability so people can borrow more and try and prop prices up? It's like trying to placate the property owners who tend to be the older voters in the world in different countries. You know, they are the ones holding the bulk of the assets. And they don't want their asset values to go down. They want to be able to sell them at somewhere near peak prices. So, you know, the governments are like, okay, well, we have to try and, you know, not let the property market collapse for those people. But we've got this growing population of young people and immigrants who are not able to rent, never mind buy, because things have become so expensive and out of reach and so obscenely more than the household income, multiples of the household income. So they've been looking at how do we extend and pretend essentially through more credit use. That's been the main playbook that most people have been talking about. But this is kind of next stage, and that's why I say China's ahead of us by a year or so in this process, and they're sort of being kind of realist and saying, you know what, we've got to figure out a way to get these properties marked down and then remade into affordable housing so that people can live there. And it's a hit to the balance sheet of those holding the properties. It's a hit to the balance sheet of the banks who lent against them. So it's quite problematic how it's all actually accomplished, but that's the thinking presently afoot.
We'll have more with Danielle Park right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Danielle Park. Danielle, electric power storage revolution. We're finding newer and better ways to store electricity that might come from alternative generative sources.
Yeah, it's really blowing up. It's amazing the innovation that's coming out of that space. And part of it is indeed some of the fiscal programs out of the U.S., you know, the so-called Inflation Reduction Act, which is really doing the most to funnel money into this space. Now, I'm not saying that there won't be some of that that's non-productive or wasted, but to the extent that it ignites demand in the private economy and gets businesses up and running with new business models or innovation in this space, that's great because it's happening all over the world. It's certainly not just in America. But the, you know, so everyone's facing this rising unemployment theme, a shrinking population, aging population, you know, so these are problematic areas to contend with. And in terms of getting the, you know, because this whole model of GDP growth is that it has to grow more every year, that consumers have to spend more every year, that house prices have to go up every year, this kind of thing. So when you get into an environment of a stagnant where you just can't keep driving that because households are already tapped out on credit, starting to default, which we're seeing across all kinds of credit types. And then you got the aging demographic and this disconnect between the haves and the have-nots. It's very hard to get incrementally more spending in the economy, certainly in the private sector. So part of the focus on the solution here is to figure out how to get costs down, which is what this whole energy revolution is about. Because if you think about it, you know, paying your utilities for natural gas and for, you know, petrol in your car and for, you know, if your heating is primarily coming through, polluting sources of energy, there's a whole bunch of full cost accounting there that goes on. It's a very taxing expense for the households, for businesses, and then there's all the waste and, you know, air pollution, health complications that come from all that. So that's all very expensive for the society, whereas if you can get these more alternative energy like wind and solar, for example, it will be it's dropping the cost of energy, and it's making it more possible that we have these local production that fuels the grid instead of these top-down, very expensive, like where people are trying to make a profit off providing energy. This is more of a everyone can kind of collect it at a municipal level, at a local level, and benefit from that. So one of the things that's happening is you're getting this innovation in the battery space where, for example, you know, a lot of talk about lithium and how expensive and difficult it is to mine, and trying to just roll out a large-scale sodium ion battery storage station. So that is, you know, sodium is very available and cheap. And so this is an alternative technology, which a few years ago people would have thought was impossible. And the other thing is recycled materials, because, you know, the price of copper, this is partly to do with this whole speculative trading mania that's going on. We saw this in the price of cocoa in the last few months, where it went straight up in a spike, you know, a short squeeze on the price of cocoa, which, of course, is just about financialization and trading in the Wall Street and other financial sector. But ultimately, it causes inflation in the price of those inputs for a whole bunch of people that are trying to make things out of it or consume it in the economy. The same thing's happened recently with copper. A big short squeeze. Again, price has gone, you know, to a very high level. And then, you know, to the extent that we need that as a critical mineral for a lot of this alternative energy build out, that can be quite inflationary and problematic. Again, you know, it's great to see the cost of goods coming down, but if you get a spike in some of these inputs, like copper, that can, you know, cause inflation to stay stickier longer and complicate this whole idea of trying to cut interest rates. So another way that people are looking at reducing the cost is through recycled materials. And that is huge. There's a lot of businesses now figuring out ways to use all the critical minerals and take them back out of, you know, batteries and other technologies, which just increases the supply. And so ultimately that's very disinflationary and helpful, because we need to, you know, probably by some estimates, we need to increase the electricity supply by at least 50% in the next few years to accommodate both the plug-in, you know, electric vehicles, which are coming, but also the AI, the, you know, robotics, all of this innovation that's coming, you know, it doesn't come for free. It's very energy intensive. So part of this, the real imperative in the world right now is figuring out how to provide this energy cheaper and more abundantly. And so there's all kinds of dollars flowing in there. So that's actually a really optimistic growth story that I think will help in the long run. In the short run, it can drive up the cost of some inputs. But as I say, some of these innovations are looking for substitution of, you know, things like sodium for lithium and otherwise recycling goods, so that they don't need to continually find new inputs for every bit of the equipment they're making.
Sodium, isn't that just salt?
Yeah, basically. One of the most abundant on the earth. So,
yeah, I've got way too familiar with sodium and high blood pressure.
Ah, there you go.
You know, yeah. I now, Ontario's so-called crypto king arrested for fraud. I'm not going to give him the publicity of releasing his name, because then he can say I was quoted on House Street. No, but again, a big warning for people, there's no such thing as easy, instant money.
Yeah, but also, you know, I think that the popularization or normalization of this space has happened by the large ETF providers, people like Vanguard, who have these long-established names of being, you know, a legitimate investment product provider, have gone into this space and, you know, made ETFs and got this all purpose in Canada. A whole bunch of them have got approval from the regulators for this concept of packaging these highly sketchy, you know, not transparent and publicly traded instruments like different crypto coins and all the various madness that goes on in that space. They've packaged them into these quote-unquote investment funds and sold them to the public. So this makes them look legitimate and, you know, reasonable as a place to put capital. And so they've attracted flows in there. But inside those wrappers, you know, inside those corporate fronts, the individual crypto companies, they're run by very, you know, unregulated, opaque, non-transparent criminals in a lot of cases, who are, you know, who the primary end user of the actual coins or digital currencies are still the money launderers and traffickers of the world. The dark money side are the ones who are using it for transactions. And now we've got, I would call it almost the dumb money crowd again, you know, quote unquote, has piled into this as an investable class of place to put money, even though they have, you know, back when rates were nothing, there was this big saying, Tina, there is no alternative. Well, now there's lots of alternatives in the sense of things that are legitimate, that are secure of principle, and that actually will pay you an income that can compound growth over time. You know, things like I said, T-bills, money market, GICs, government bonds, things that are much more reasonable or traditional for people to grow their money in. But they're still being attracted because sentiment is still high, and it's very interesting because investor sentiment is back at all-time highs. Money managers have the highest allocations to equities ever in history. The investor sentiment allocation to bonds and cash is at near an all-time low. But that is in stark contrast to the really desperate consumer sentiment numbers, which are showing that people are feeling as bad as they did at the depths of the 08 recession, that they're defaulting on debt at the level they did in the 08 recession. So it's this really weird disconnect right now between, as I say, the financial economy and financialization and products and the actual real economy where unemployment is rising, where cost of living is still high, where renewals are coming up and pushing up the cost of capital for people, and making it really challenging. So at some point, I think that the financial economy or the financial markets will once again have to reconnect with the reality of the real economy, and we're going to see a cash crunch in that regard.
Are we getting close to being in French Revolution standards where they go after the rich because everybody else is so poor?
Well, I hope not. I really hope not, but I do worry that traditionally when the status quo and, you know, refuses to do things that are better for the collective good and wants to insist on their monopolies and their, you know, subsidies and things that retain things in the interest of a few at the cost of everyone else, that you ultimately do get pretty violent events in history. So we will see. I hope we don't have to do that before we start to see what's needing to be changed here.
Danielle, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Hey, thank you very much.
My guest has been Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. If you have any questions for Danielle or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on X at How Street. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.